All right, so picture this. You're watching a beach volleyball match. A player goes up for a block. The ball screams past their hands, lands in the sand, and the ref calls touch. And you're sitting there like, did they actually touch it?
Every single time. And the replay is useless because the camera angle is wrong and the ref is standing 12 meters away making a life or death call based on vibes.
Based on vibes. And here's what's wild. We've been building a computer vision system for, what, going on 3 years now in the series. We can track the ball. We can track the skeleton. We can flatten the court. But the actual moment of contact, the instant skin meets leather, that's still one of the hardest problems in the entire pipeline.
Because pixels don't feel things.
Exactly. Camera sees positions. It doesn't feel impact. So the question becomes, how do you prove something happened that you can't directly observe? And the answer, it turns out, is the same method that's been used for centuries in fields that have nothing to do with sports.
I'm intrigued. What fields?
Well, let's start with wine.
I mean, I'm always down to start with wine.
So the Master Sommelier exam. This is one of the hardest professional certifications on the planet. Something like a 3% pass rate on the final level. And the centerpiece is blind tasting. They put a glass in front of you. And you have to identify the grape, the region, the vintage, sometimes down to the specific vineyard, from a glass of liquid you've never seen before.
That's absurd.
How?
Cheers the thing. They don't just drink it and guess. There's a formal evaluation grid, and it forces you to analyze each sensory channel independently and in sequence. First you look. Just look. You write down color, opacity, viscosity. The visual tells you things about age and body before you've smelled anything. Then you nose it. You write those notes before you taste. Then palate. Then structure, tannin, acidity, finish. And you do not let what you see contaminate what you smell.
Wait, that's a rule. You're not allowed to cross-reference while you're evaluating.
It's the entire discipline. Because if you see a deep ruby color and your brain screams Cabernet, your nose will find Cabernet even if the glass is Malbec. The visual channel biases the olfactory channel, so the grid forces you to keep them separate until the very end, when you combine all your independent notes into a final identification.
That's not wine appreciation, that's an architecture pattern.
It is literally an architecture pattern. And it's the same one we need for touch detection, because we have three independent signals that can each tell us something about whether contact happened, and if we smash them together too early. The strong signal drowns out the weak one and we get worse results than if we kept them apart.
Okay, walk me through the three signals.
Signal one is what we've had from the beginning. Trajectory physics. The ball follows a parabolic arc under gravity and drag. You can model that. And when the ball suddenly deviates from where physics says it should be, when the actual position doesn't match the predicted position, something hit it. A 2023 paper by Chen and Agarwal on basketball shot tracking showed that fitting a kinematic model and detecting discontinuities is a reliable contact indicator. The ball was going here, now it's going there. The deviation is your evidence.
That makes total sense for a spike. Huge trajectory change. But what about a tip? A roll shot? There's barely changed direction.
And that's the failure mode of signal one. Card contacts. Great. Soft touches. The angle change might be within your tracking noise. You literally can't tell it from chitter.
So you need another set of eyes.
Signal two. Skeleton proximity. We've got pose estimation running. Media pipe, or RTM pose from MM pose, giving us joint positions every frame. Ball detection gives us the ball position. If the ball is within some pixel radius of a hand or arm joint, that's a potential touch.
But that's the ghost touch problem, right? The ball passes close to a hand all the time without contact. A player pulls their hand away from an out ball and it passes like 3 centimeters from their fingers.
Exactly. Proximity gives you false positives constantly. A player swings and misses. The hand was right there. The ball was right there, but no contact. Proximity doesn't know about misses.
So signal one fails on soft touches, signal two fails on near misses. Please tell me signal three is better.
Signal three to sound.
Wait. You're going to listen for the hit.
Here's where it gets wild. There's a 2024 study by Campanagara and Sassari, published in the International Journal of Sport and Exercise Psychology, that showed volleyball serve impacts produce a distinctive acoustic signature peaking in the 2 to 4 kHz range. And this is the part that blew my mind. Expert volleyball players can predict where the ball will land based on the sound of the serve alone. The frequency spectrum encodes contact quality. It's not just a thud. It's an informationally rich signal.
Hold on. Players are already doing audio analysis with their ears.
With their brains. Their brains are fusing visual and auditory channels to assess contact quality. Campanicar and Cesari showed this explicitly. Experienced players use sound to predict serve placement. We're trying to build a system that replicates what a trained human cortex already does unconsciously.
That's beautiful and also kind of humbling.
It gets better. Sony AI published work in 2024, Martin, Shute, and colleagues, where they trained a six-layer CNN on mouse spectrograms from table tennis and classified not just whether contact happened, but what surface the ball hit, racket versus table versus floor, and even estimated spin from sound alone. MEL spectrograms, 64 MEL bands, outperformed raw spectrograms and every other audio representation they tested.
Wait, they could tell spin from sound.
From sound. And Tamaki and Yoda's earlier work from 2006, the foundational IEEE paper on ball hit detection in table tennis, hit 95% detection using audio energy peaks, though that dropped to about 73% recall before their MFCC refinement step cleaned it up.
Okay, but those are all indoor sports.
Table tennis squash.
Beach volleyball is, you know, outside.
With wind and crowds, and that DJ the tournament always hires who plays the same 15 songs.
Right, and this connects directly to what we talked about in episode 217, the cocktail party problem. Colin Cherry's foundational question, how does your brain isolate one voice in a room full of voices? We're asking the same thing but harder. How do you isolate a ball contact sound from wind, crowd noise, music, the adjacent courts game?
So audio outdoors is unreliable.
Unreliable as a primary detector, but potentially very valuable as a confirming signal. And this is where the sommelier grid comes back. You don't skip the nose just because you're in a noisy restaurant. You acknowledge that the nose channel is degraded in this environment, you weight it accordingly, and you still include its testimony in your final identification.
I love that framing. It's not about finding the perfect signal. It's about combining imperfect signals correctly.
Which brings us to the actual architecture question. And for this I want to borrow from something much older than machine learning.
Older than wine.
Way older. Land surveying, specifically triangulation, which is a practice that goes back centuries. You stand at one point. You take a measurement to a distant landmark. What do you know?
The direction, but not the distance, not really.
You know a line of possibility. The landmark is somewhere along that line. Now you move to a second point. Take another measurement. The two lines intersect, and that intersection is your location estimate.
And a third measurement gives you confidence.
Exactly. A third measurement from a third position gives you error bounds. And here's the key. Each instrument has different error characteristics. Clinodolite is precise for angles, but useless for elevation. A chain is precise for distance, but requires direct line of sight. A level is precise for elevation, but tells you nothing about horizontal position. Each tool lies in a different direction. And when you combine instruments that lie in different directions, the lies cancel out and truth emerges from the intersection.
That's such a clean way to think about it.
Trajectory physics lies about soft touches.
Proximity lies about near misses. Audio lies about wind noise.
But they are lying about different things.
Different things. And the research backs this up. A 2018 study by Kanegan and colleagues employs one built an acoustic event framework for squash and found something crucial. Training a single model on audio from all six microphone channels performed worse than treating each channel separately, because each mic had different acoustic properties relative to the court geometry. Pooling them was early fusion. Keeping them separate was late fusion. Late fusion won.
So what does late fusion actually look like in practice?
Each channel produces its own independent prediction. Channel A, trajectory physics, says contact probability 0.8, timestamp frame 247. Channel B, skeleton proximity, says contact probability 0.6, timestamp frame 247, body part, right hand. Channel C, audio, says contact probability 0.4, timestamp frame 248. Then a lightweight combiner could be as simple as require agreement from at least two of three channels within a 100-millisecond window, makes the final call.
Wait, why is the audio timestamp one frame later?
And this is a detail that almost nobody thinks about. Sound travels at about 343 meters per second. If your microphone is 15 meters from the contact point, the sound arrives about 44 milliseconds after the visual event. At 30 frames per second, that's more than one full frame of latency. If you don't compensate for the speed of sound, your fusion window will systematically misalign audio and video evidence.
That's the kind of thing that would drive you insane debugging.
Everything looks right, but the numbers don't agree, and it's because light and sound arrive at different times.
The surveyors had this problem too. By the way, different instruments require different corrections. Temperature affects chain length. Atmospheric refraction bends the theodolite's line of sight. You calibrate each instrument independently before you trust the intersection.
Okay, so I want to push back on something. You've got three signals, you combine them, great. But to train any of these classifiers, don't you need labeled examples of contact? And labeling contacts is the thing you're trying to automate.
And there it is, the ground truth recursion from episode 195. You need labeled contacts to train the detector that labels contacts. Poison gold all over again.
So how do you bootstrap?
You start with the obvious cases. Par-driven spikes where all three channels scream contact. Trajectory changes dramatically. Hand is clearly on the ball. You can hear it. You label those first, then you use those confident labels to train initial classifiers, and you gradually extend to the ambiguous cases, the controversial sets, the tips, the roll shots.
And your grading philosophy. This is the episode 196 problem, right?
The 90.8% that collapsed to 62.9% when someone was scored with stricter criteria.
Whatever threshold you pick for two or three channels agree encodes a judgment about what counts as contact.
Exactly. And this is worth naming. The fusion architecture itself is a map, and every map is an argument. Choosing late fusion over early fusion is an argument that says each modality's independent judgment is more trustworthy than their raw data combined. Choosing which signal gets veto power, like saying no contact unless trajectory confirms, is an argument about which evidence you trust most. You're not discovering truth. You're designing a system of judgment and being honest about what you prioritized.
That's heavy. I like it. So let me bring in something from episode 212.
The C student equation.
You argued that weak signals still have value when combined with strong ones.
Audio outdoors is probably a C student signal, but you're saying it still matters.
It matters because it fails differently. Remember the ghost touch problem. The ball passes close to a player's hand with no contact. Vision says touch. Trajectory says maybe. The angle change is ambiguous. But if there's no sound, no contact, Audio just saved you from a false positive.
The C student showed up on the one question the A students got wrong.
And that's the whole point. There's a parallel here to something Frank Herbert wrote in Dune. The Bene Gesserit truthers. The Reverend Mother reads voice pitch, pupil dilation, skin flush, micro-expressions, all simultaneously. No single channel is reliable. A skilled liar can control their voice or their eyes, but controlling all channels at once, nearly impossible. The truthsayer's power comes from cross-referencing independent signals. Deception that fools one channel gets caught by another.
So a ghost touch is basically a volleyball ball trying to lie to your system.
And it can fool the proximity check. It might even fool the trajectory model if the tracking jitters. But it can't produce a contact sound that isn't there. Three independent witnesses are harder to fool than one.
This also connects to episode 204, doesn't it? Bernstein's blacksmiths. The arm path was different every time, but the hammer hit the same spot.
The process varied. The outcome was consistent.
That's the flip side. Bernstein showed that the path to contact varies. A player might set the ball with a completely different arm motion depending on whether they're moving forward, backward, sideways, off balance. The skeleton looks different every time, but the outcome, ball deflects, specific sound produced, proximity confirmed. That's what you measure. You're not detecting a specific motion. You're detecting the consequence of any motion that results in contact.
Variable input, consistent output. That's why you can't just template match what a set looks like from the skeleton.
Right. The skeleton channel tells you a hand was near the ball. The trajectory channel tells you if the ball changed direction. The audio channel tells you something made the right sound. None of them know what happened. But together, they triangulate the truth.
Three surveyors with different instruments, different positions, different error profiles. And the intersection is contact.
That's the design. And honestly, the most interesting thing about all of this isn't the technical architecture. It's that we're reverse engineering something every experienced volleyball player already does. Campanicar and Sassari proved it. Expert players fuse visual and auditory information in real time to assess contacts. We're just trying to write down what their brains do without thinking.
Which, when you put it that way, is kind of the whole show. Things that seem like magic are actually systems. And systems can be described.
And Bill, badly, at first. But Bill.
So where does this go next?
You've got the architecture, you've got the three channels. What's the next wall you're going to hit?
Honestly, the thing I keep circling back to is the labeling problem, but at a deeper level. We've talked about ground truth. We've talked about grading philosophy, but there's a step before all of that which we've never really dug into, and it's, how do you decide what categories even exist? Before you can label contact or no contact, you need a taxonomy. What counts as a contact type? Is a block touch the same category as a set? Is a net touch a contact? Is a foot save? The classification scheme itself is an argument. And I think there's a whole episode in how taxonomies get built, who builds them, and what gets lost when you draw the lines wrong.
Oh, that sounds like a philosophy episode wearing a data science costume. I'm in.
It always is on this show.
All right, that's the episode. If you want to read the actual research, Campanagara and Sassari's 2024 paper on volleyball surf sounds is in the International Journal of Sport and Exercise Psychology. The Sony AI Table Tennis Audio work by Martin and Schutte is on Arxiv. And the Squash Acoustics study by Kanagan and colleagues is in PLOS 1, 2018. Links, as always, in the show notes. We'll see you next week.
See you next week.